And we're going to continue with the conversation for today, Q&A, and as we go along, please just whatever you want to interrupt or whatever, please do so. There's actually quite a few questions to ask him. But anyway, please interrupt at any time if you want to add something to the question or whatever it is. Okay, so here we go. How deep should we cultivate our sila before we can achieve better success in our meditation? Okay, so basically the two of them, allow them to go together, right? Sila and meditation can all work hand in hand. And even in the beginning, even if your sila isn't that good yet, if you practice a little bit of meditation as well, then it will still help you to make your sila even more powerful. Because when you feel a bit more peaceful, then when you feel that you have a bit more compassion and better for the people around you, it's easier to practice sila, right? Easier to be kind to others when you feel at peace and you feel relaxed and you feel at ease yourself. The two go together. So just do, when you practice meditation, don't have any clear goals in mind or think, oh, I have to sit at least half an hour, right? Anything like that. But do what feels quite natural to you now. 10 minutes is what feels natural to you, just do 10 minutes. If half an hour feels good, do half an hour. Whatever is natural is good. Some days maybe you don't want to sit at all. No meditation, that's fine as well. Other days maybe you want to sit a little bit extra, that is fine as well. Or maybe you don't want to do any meditation, that's also okay. But at least keep your sila is the first thing. And then try, every now and again, if you go on a little retreat, like a weekend retreat somewhere, practice your meditation practice, and then see if you get some results out of your ordinary practice of Buddhism. And if you practice sila the right way, then when you go on a weekend retreat or something, I don't know how much you have of these things here in KL, but you know, if you come to Jhana Grove occasionally and take part in a retreat, if you like it, Jhana Grove is very nice. And you will find that one of the advantages of doing that, of going on a retreat every now and again, is you will find out whether your ordinary practice in daily life actually is working. If your ordinary practice in daily life is working, it means that when you go on retreat, you feel every year the retreat is going a little bit better. Meditation is becoming more profound. Your mindfulness is increasing, right? This is what you find. And if mindfulness is not increasing, if your meditation is not becoming more profound, it means that there's probably something you can do about your sila to change your life a little bit to actually allow that mindfulness to become more powerful. So this is one of the ways of finding out whether you're making progress or not, by going on a retreat every now and again and see how your meditation is going. The most important thing is always the sila. This is the foundation for everything else. Okay. Yes. Microphone. Yeah.
Thank you. I have a friend, normally I go to retreat and meditate. They just tell me that you don't have to meditate, you just have to become good people. Because after all, meditation is just applying what you've been in meditation that applies to daily life. And so they say you just become a good people and become good people, do the good act. You just don't have to meditate. So you don't have to be going to retreat and you just stay at home and be good and everything will be good. Just wonder if the meditation is a must if let's say you want to become enlightened, just more better and better.
Well, it all depends on what your aspiration is, right? What are you trying to achieve in this life? And if your aspiration is just to be a good person, to have a good heart, and then perhaps, you know, in your next life you continue having a good life, then having good sila is good enough. But if you think you want to go a little bit further on this path, if you also want to, you know, purify your mind and develop your meditation a little bit, if you can, it's a wonderful thing because it's very powerful. And it's very, you know, once you get into a good meditation for the first time, it gives a different idea of life. Life looks different afterwards. There's a very nice simile of this in the suttas. There's a simile of two men, they're living in a village, and near the village there's a mountain. So they walk up to this mountain, and then one of the men, he goes to the top of the mountain. and he looks out and he sees all these things. He says, wow, I can see really far. I can see all these villages, all these fields, all the forests, all these things. So he shouts out to his friend, oh, I can see all this stuff from the top of the mountain. And the friend of mine says, no way, I don't believe you. You can't see anything from the top of that stupid mountain. So he goes down, the one on the top, he comes down and takes him by the arm. Okay, I'm going to show you. He pulls him up to the top of the mountain. And he says, look, what do you see? Oh yeah, I see the village. I see exactly what you're saying. Yeah. And this is a simile. The simile here is that if you attain samadhi, if you go, if you get a deep state of meditation, the world looks different. You're looking as if you're on top of the mountain. You're looking down. And when you're looking down, you see your own life in perspective. You understand what sensuality is all about. You understand, because now, when you live in the middle of sensuality all the time, you don't really understand what it is. Right? You don't have a full perspective of it. But once you go to the top of the mountain, you look down, suddenly, now I understand what it's all about. Now I understand about attachment. Now I understand about all the belongings I have and how they all fit in, right? Why? Because you have been free of all that for the first time in your life. And when you have been free of it, you no longer have any vested interest, no desire, all that is removed. You can see it clearly for the first time. So it is very powerful. If you have a little bit of more aspiration in your Buddhist life, and just being kind and good, and then going and retreat every now and again can be very, very useful there. Right? And also it's good fun, right? If you come on the retreat with Ajahn Brahm, he tells all these jokes, right? You have a good time, you laugh, you hear nice stories. Wow, you can't really go wrong. So choose your retreats well. Depending on what kind of person you are, some retreats are incredibly strict, right? So if you feel like you want to be a little bit soft in the beginning, I recommend you to be soft in the beginning. It's always wise that you can go on the strict retreats later on if you wish. But you should really have a good foundation in meditation before you go on really strict retreats. So come, you know, do something nice and simple, enjoy yourself. Sometimes it's great to get away anyway, right? Go on a nice holiday to Perth, right? Do a meditation retreat. You can't really go wrong with that kind of thing. So, yeah. Anyway, okay. Let's go on to the next question. Here I am, Madhyama Nikaya 20, the removal of thoughts. It is said that a person should give attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome. Then there arises in him bad and wholesome thoughts connected with desire. Can you give an example of desire? For instance, lust or desire to possess, and how this can be overcome by giving attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome. Sure, okay, it's easy, right? So you are sitting there, you are meditating, everything is going well, and suddenly you start thinking about, you know, you want to eat, right? You want to eat, you know, oh, I'm feeling really hungry now, you can think of something very nice to eat. That is like a sensual desire arising in you. You talk about desire to possess or lust, okay, so any of that sort of stuff, right, whether it's about relationships or your girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever it is, all of these desires can arise while you are sitting and doing your meditation practice. So the way to overcome that there's many things, but the first, I will talk a little bit about this later on in this retreat, talking about sensual desires specifically. But one of the things, remember, you can actually feel that desire you're having. It is like you feel an unfulfilled state inside of yourself. You feel like you are looking to the future to find happiness, right? You feel empty inside, something is missing in your life. There's something unpleasant about that state of desire. Desire is always about not feeling fulfilled and complete in the present moment. The moment you come into mindfulness, the moment that your mind settles in the present moment, you have much more feeling of compassion, of being a full person, rather than being this kind of scattered person with desires all over the place. This is one way of understanding the danger in desire, right? Bring it back to the present moment. The second thing is to understand, well, all this fantasizing, you can fantasize about food now, you can fantasize about relationships or whatever it is, but you can't get it, right? You're sitting here, you're meditating, you're supposed to enjoy the meditation. It's crazy to go out thinking about all of this stuff. You can't have it anyway, you can't eat now. There's no food here, right? How are you going to eat? And then all you're doing is that you're creating this pictured in your mind, which is then causing craving and causing problems without actually giving you any satisfaction. So when you think about it, it doesn't make any sense, right, to think about those things. All you're doing is torturing yourself. Do you want to torture yourself? The answer, of course, is no, don't really want to do that. So you let go of those things. It's easy to say, right? In reality, it is often difficult. Because in reality, you sit there, meditation isn't going anywhere, you're feeling tired, or I wish I was back home, I don't really want to be here anymore. Sometimes you feel like that when you go on a retreat. And of course, then the fantasizing seems better than the present moment. And because the fantasizing seems preferable to the present moment, that's what you do. So part of this is also to learn to find the joy in meditation practice. When you find the joy in meditation practice, all that fantasizing seems crazy because we have much more happiness in meditation than you have fantasizing. So a lot of it is about actually finding the joy in meditation. That's why it is so important to enjoy meditation practice. Don't make it a torture. If you torture yourself in meditation, you're going to fantasize even more about whatever it is you fantasize about. Because you don't want to be here, right? It's just painful. Why, you know, of course you're going to fantasize. So enjoy it. This is so important. Once you find the joy, it will happen by itself. Okay, so I'm going to talk more about sensuality tomorrow. So hopefully that will also give you some ways of dealing with that. Okay, next one. Okay, there's three questions in one, so very... Lothian Ajahn, could you please explain how the monk's robe evolved? Why is the upper robe part of the shoulder exposed? Is there a significance in the colors of the robe of the different Buddhist traditions? How did the monk's robe... okay, how did the monk's robe evolve? Well, actually, the original robe was that monks used were probably not exactly like this, because the upper robe that we have now is very long and very big. In the early days it was probably much shorter. So you had a sarong and then you had a shorter upper robe on top. That's probably what it was like at the time of the Buddha. So this robe we have now is actually much bigger than it was at that time. Why is one shoulder exposed? The reason for that is because if you want to bow to the Buddha, for example, it is considered impolite to cover both your shoulders. In ancient India, when you met somebody important, you would often circumambulate them, right? Like we do now, we circumambulate the stupa, or we circumambulate something we consider important. In those days, it is happening. When you circumambulate one shoulder, the shoulder that you have towards the person is supposed to be bare. That is the polite way. If you cover both shoulders, it is not polite to bow down to somebody or to circumambulate something. That is just an ancient tradition coming from ancient India. Why exactly what it is, I'm not sure. But that's why sometimes today you see a Buddhist monk will come somewhere. If he has both shoulders covered, he will often not bow to the Buddha statue because it would be considered impolite to do so. That's really all it is. But when, as a monk, you go into the village, for example, if I were to go into KL or go down in the street here, because this is like a temple in a sense, I'm covering one shoulder. But once I go out in public, then you should always cover both shoulders. Right? This is how it works. Supposed to be covered when you go into public. So this is kind of, staying here is kind of intermediate. It's hard to know whether it's public or whether it's kind of a monastery or whether it's kind of in between. So I just do it this way. It's so hot anyway, right? that is how it works. Okay. Colors of the robe, is it significant? Well, the colors of the robes are basically, remember, in ancient India, the colors were natural dyes, the dye that you got from the trees, right? So you would chop up the trees and you get the dye from the chips of the trees, you boil the chips and all this kind of stuff. So natural dyes, that's why the robes had to be brown. In other traditions, if you go to the Mahayana traditions, things change. When you go to China or you go to, you know, you often have grey robes or black robes even. Brown? Yeah? So some of them And exactly how that evolved, I'm not sure about. But they obviously, they also changed their style. They're using trousers, they're using jackets and all this kind of thing. So they also changed the style. And probably that has to do with the weather, right? If you go to the north of China, it's very cold. This kind of robe probably wouldn't do. You'd probably freeze to death. So those who wore these robes, they disappeared, and the ones who wore the older ones, they So they had to be practical about things. And this is one of the reasons I was saying before that in ancient India, the robes of a layperson and a monastic were almost the same. So when they went to China, it was probably acceptable to wear trousers because the robes, again, of the monastics and the lay people were probably roughly the same. So you see, when you see Mahayana monastics, they don't look like lay people, even though they're wearing trousers. They look like monastics because their trousers and jacket are styled differently from ordinary lay people's clothes. Okay, so I think it's okay. I don't think it's wrong to wear Mahayana robes. I think it's okay, right? It's not a problem. Okay, how do monks keep warm during the winter? Okay, you put on more clothes, right? Easy. Sometimes, you know, you can use things like long underwear, right, in the middle of the winter, so use long underwear, and then you'll be fine. That's how you do things. So. Okay, 2 years ago, I went for a meditation course at one stage, I find myself forgetting my pants. What? what did he forget about? Is it pants? No. Sorry? My body, and it was my parts or my body? I think it is. Okay. Parts, my body, and it was such a peaceful feeling. My pains, is it maybe it is? Pain, my body, feeling. Your pains probably, but it's okay, pains, right there. A few days later, I woke up abruptly from my sleep because I saw a vision of myself drowning. I am scared of meditating now because if that vision, whether it was from my past life or from my future, please explain how I can contemplate further on this. Okay, so that is great that you had, you know, all the pains were gone and your body disappeared and you had a peaceful feeling. That's wonderful, right? So remember that you had a good experience there as well. It wasn't just a bad one, it was also a good experience. And then a few days later, you woke up from my sleep because I saw a vision of myself drowning. It's probably just a dream, right? It probably has nothing to do with the meditation practice as such. Probably just a dream. Everybody sometimes has unpleasant dreams, right? Sometimes, you know, I remember as a child, I had dreams of falling off buildings, that kind of thing. And it was really strange. I remember fall off a building, but I didn't wake up, so I fell to the ground. And I thought, wait, what happened? And then I get up and I walk off, right? It was really weird, this tall building falling off. Usually people wake up from those dreams, but I didn't even wake up from that one. So the point is, it's just a dream, right? It doesn't mean anything. Just because you were doing a meditation retreat doesn't mean it's a bad omen. It is just something that is happening. And it is very likely that if you have dreams like that, it comes from somewhere in the past. It's got nothing to do with the future. Very few people have prophetic dreams. Most of the dreams are just the stuff from the past, that's happening from the past. Right? When I dreamt about falling off a building, that was 30 years ago. I still haven't fallen off a building, so it can't be prophetic yet. So don't worry about those things. Just do what you feel is comfortable. Right? I don't know how you feel about being here with all the people, if you are comfortable doing meditation in the morning. If you are enjoying that, then keep on enjoying that. It's that simple. Do whatever you feel comfortable with, whatever you feel at ease with, you feel relaxed with. If you start to feel uncomfortable, then just stop. Try different types of meditation techniques. Do some metta, while wishing all beings well. It is very, very useful. I know that apparently you teach that here at the BGF as well. So do some metta meditation. It is very useful for helping you to purify yourself and to be a more kind person to other people. So do all of those things. But there's nothing to worry about. You know, everybody has unpleasant dreams sometimes. It doesn't mean anything at all. Just go on with your life and do what is useful for yourself. Don't allow you to be stopped by these kind of things. Otherwise, you will not get anywhere in your spiritual life. So don't, yeah, so just ignore that, please. P.S. I have a strong belief that this drowning incident was my past, because from young I made sure I learned how to swim, but it still remains a mystery. So there you are, so you have a strong feeling it was my past, right? So trust that feeling, it's probably right. It is very, very likely to be right, because where do all the strange dreams and stuff come from? It must come from something in our consciousness that we're carrying with us, most likely from the past. Okay, good. Okay, here at Ramali, it's natural that monks would view great arahants like Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Mahamoggallana as their role models. Sometimes it's difficult for lay people to emulate a great monk completely, considering that we lead very different lifestyles. Are there any stories or examples of great Buddhist lay people during the time of the Buddha that we can take as our role models? Yes, there is. There are role models. In fact, there's a sutta about almost anything. There's a sutta about that too, about the role models you should take as lay people or as monastics for that matter. And there is the model that lay men. There's also different models for men and women, right? Because sometimes it's easier to relate to somebody of your own gender, perhaps. So for a man, it's easier to take another man as a model. For a woman, it might be easier to take another woman as a role model. So for lay men, there are two people that are pointed out, and that is, the one is Citta. Citta was an anagami, so still pretty high up, right? Maybe not like, still quite high compared to most people, but he was a lay person. He was an anagami, a non-returner. Very deep meditation, had very good samadhi before jhana, and given that so much it was almost an arahant, almost a monastic. And the other one was a lay person called Hataka of Alalika, and he was similar to Citta, also very, very, very noble person, getting the jhanas, but having, was also an anagami, and he was very famous for having a very large entourage. He had all these people following him everywhere, right? He was incredibly popular. So whenever he went to the Buddha, he had 500 people coming after him. Imagine that, it was tiring after a while, having 500 people following him everywhere. And he was famous for practicing what is called the Sangaha Bandhuna, the basis for collecting together a group. And these are the things you have to practice to become popular, basically. So this is the one thing you find in the Sutta. How do you become popular? How do you get people to like you? These are the four Sangaha Vattus. What are the four? Anybody here want to become popular? If you don't want to become popular, just close your ears. It's interesting that this is part of the Sutras, right? But it shows you how, why it is people are attracted to you. And let's see if I can remember these four. So the first one is, I can't remember the sequence anymore, but one is being generous to people, right? You are generous. You are, whenever people have some need or whatever, you are there. You are helpful to other people, so you help them out. Whenever they need something, you help them out. You use kind speech, paya vachaka, right? You speak softly, you speak in a friendly way, you say the right things. And the last one is you treat everybody in the same way. You don't have favorites, you don't have one person who you treat with a lot of kindness and other people you treat with contempt. You treat people in the same way. You're kind to everybody. Well, that's quite nice when people are like that. Sometimes it's easy to kind of, if somebody is very important, you're very nice to them. If somebody is kind of low down, you treat them in a bad way. But actually, it's a sign of a kind of spiritual advancement, that you treat everybody the same, regardless of whether they are low on the social hierarchy or high in the social hierarchy, whether they are rich or poor, whether they are whatever, you treat people roughly the same way. So these are the, this is what Hataka of Alavi was famous for. He had all these people around him all the time. And for lay women now, what are the lay women again now who were supposed to be used as examples? I think one was Kujutra, I think. And what was the other one? The other one was can't remember now anymore. Not Visakha, no. It was not Visakha, because Visakha doesn't seem to have been that spiritually attained. These were even more spiritually attained, these lay women. There should be two. So how did they?
One.
Okay. One? Is it one lady? Okay. Great. Yeah. Well done. Okay. Long list. Okay. No, it wasn't that I had in mind, actually. It was what I had in mind is the truth, but I won't find it anywhere. Okay, here we are. Got it. Okay, so this is, I can actually read the sutta for you, isn't that great? This is the sutta, a very short one. Because a female lay follower endowed with faith, rightly aspiring, should aspire thus. May I become like the female lay follower, Kujutara. That's what I just said before, so I got it right. That's Kujutara. And the other one is Velukantika Nanda Mata. So they are quite obscure, right? That's why I couldn't really remember the names, because they're not quite as common. So, and there is actually one sutta about Velukantika Nanda Mata. Maybe I'll look at sutta now, because it's quite a nice one there. This is the standard and criterion for my female lay disciples. That is the female lay followers of Kujutara and Velukantika Nanda Mata. So there is a sutta in the eighth about all the qualities of Velukantika Nanda Mata, and they're actually very nice. So I'll read that out for you now, and you can